A new official report slams U.S. police for the slow response to a deadly shooting at an elementary school in Texas. It says more decisive action could have saved lives. A top Russian security official says the refusal of NATO members to recognize Moscow's authority over Crimea represents a systemic threat to his country. Hundreds of flights are canceled in Italy during a vacation travel peak following a strike by aviation workers over working conditions. Welcome to World News from Tehran with me, Behrouz Najafi. Another shooting in the United States. A gunman opens fire inside a mall in the state of Indiana, killing three people and wounding two others before being shot dead.
What we do know right now is that we have what appears to be one shooter. It looks to be an adult male. We have not identified him yet. We do not have a motive yet. It appears that he had a rifle with several magazines of ammunition. Entered the food court and began shooting. We have five victims. Four have been confirmed deceased, and two are at Eskenazi Hospital with wounds, and we do not have an update on their condition at this time.
Now, according to officials, the gunman was alone and was shot by an armed bystander at the mall. Police say they investigated the incident, and this is the latest in the spate of gun violence in the U.S. Recent incidents include a shooting in an elementary school in Texas that left 19 children and two teachers dead. A new report by Texas state lawmakers slams law enforcement's slow response to the shooting, saying more decisive action could have saved lives. The incidents have ignited debates over the necessity for stricter gun control laws. This week, a committee in the House of Representatives would vote on a bill that bans assault rifles. The vote is a first in over 20 years. A senior Iranian official says that the Islamic Republic will respond in kind to any measure by neighboring countries against its national security. Kamal Karazi, head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations, was referring to the countries that have normalized relations with Israel. He stressed that targeting Iran's security by those countries will also meet a direct response to Israel. Karazi pointed to Iran's extensive military drills, saying that they aim to send a message that Iran is capable of hitting targets deep inside Israel in case its vital and sensitive facilities are targeted. He also rejected allegations that Iran is in pursuit of nukes, saying that the Islamic Republic has no such intention, despite technical capabilities to do so. Now let's move on. Shiite Muslims in Iran and other countries are celebrating Eid al-Qadir, which is one of the main festivities on the Islamic calendar. That's the anniversary of the day Prophet Muhammad named his cousin and son-in-law, Ali ibn Abi Talib, as his successor and the head of the Muslim community. Imam Ali, the first Shiite imam, was named by the Prophet at a location outside of Mecca called Qadir Khum. The occasion is marked every year at the end of the Hajj season. Now, to get some insight on that from the Iranian city of Qom, I'm joined by Muzaffar Haider, who's the creative director of the Islamic Pulse. Good to have you with us, Muzaffar. So, what Qadir means, its significance, and the message that it carries?
Eid al-Qadir is a very important Eid. It's one of the biggest Eids, and according to the Shia school of thought, actually, it's the king of all Eids. And it's the fateful day where the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam held up the hand of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali was his cousin and son-in-law. He held up his hand, and this was in front of a huge crowd of people after the final Hajj that the Prophet had performed. Some of the ahadith say 120,000 plus people were present at that time. And it was quite a show, actually, because he asked all of these companions to gather their saddles and to create a makeshift stage. Upon this stage, he climbed in front of those crowds, held up the hand of Imam Ali alayhi salam, and he said, "Man kuntu mawla fahada aliyun mawla," which basically means, "For whomsoever I am the mawla, the master, this Ali is also the mawla." And there's an entire context behind it, which proves without a shadow of doubt that Ali alayhi salam was the rightful successor of the Holy Prophet. And for this reason, the Muslims, predominantly Shia Muslims, although Sunni Muslims I'm sure would do it in some areas as well, they celebrate this Eid, and there's festivities that take place, families meet each other, there's lighting. Right now, alhamdulillah, I'm blessed to be in the holy city of Qom, and so the streets are full of lights and big banners, and people often greet each other and say Eid Mubarak. So it's a really nice Eid, alhamdulillah.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Muzaffar Haider, Creative Director of the Islamic Pulse. Now, former Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has stressed that Crimea is part and parcel of his country. He also called for the recognition of Moscow's sovereignty over the region. Medvedev said that the refusal of Ukraine and NATO to recognize Crimea as part of Russia represents a systemic and direct threat to his country. He underlined that Crimea, which rejoined Russia following a referendum in 2014, is now Russian soil. The comments were aired today after Ukrainian military warned that Crimea could be a target for U.S.-made missiles recently deployed by Kiev as it is battling Russian forces. Ukraine called it a justified target of attack, claiming that Russia had performed strikes on its territories from Crimea and Black Sea. Ukrainian president has abruptly fired the head of the Domestic Security Agency and the State Prosecutor General. Volodymyr Zelensky says that more than 60 members of their agencies are found to be collaborating with Moscow in Russia-controlled parts of Ukraine. He said that the problem has also touched other agencies. Zelensky says that over 650 cases of suspected treason and aiding and abetting Russia by Ukrainian security officials are being investigated. Now, this is the biggest of their kind since Russia launched its military operation in Ukraine. The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries. Global supply chains have been disrupted. There are fears of food shortages. Economists fear the situation in Europe could even worsen as the continent is struggling to find middle ground on solutions to the current uncertainties.
Gas supplies to Europe have tightened and fuel costs have soared since Russia's conflict with Ukraine in February and subsequent sanctions, leaving countries scrambling to refill storage and diversify supply channels. But despite the heavy costs incurred by their citizens, the Russophobia sentiment by many EU countries, especially those with close ties with the US, continues unabated. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and Italy are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. But now the EU seems to have imposed sanctions on Moscow without having a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. A clear example of sanctions backfiring would be Germany, which recently reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. While the sanctions on Russia were meant to pressure Moscow in light of its special operation in Ukraine, the backfiring of the EU measures have given birth to disagreements between politicians and the bloc. The Hungarian Prime Minister has said that a failure in rolling back the sanctions on Russia risks the destruction of the European economy. Viktor Orban said European leaders should reconsider their strategy, as sanctions have caused widespread damage to the European economy without weakening Russia or bringing the months-long war closer to any resolution.
Absolutely. I think that the Hungarian leader, Viktor Orban, right now is saying what is meant to be unsaid and unspoken, is that basically the sanctions, this pressure campaign from the European Union against Russia because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is having a blowback, as the CIA used to put the term, in that the sanctions are actually working against the European economy. And what Orban was addressing was the fuel crisis that exists right now, compounded with the inflation that we see around the world. We're looking at fuel prices increasing, fuel shortages, and issues with fuel supply and logistics to get that fuel to the European market and to many of the nations. Remember that Hungary is landlocked, so it imports most of its oil via pipeline. And so right now we are witnessing a pretty catastrophic next few months and what some people are predicting to be a very tough winter for Europe.
As it stands, top CEOs are fearing the worst in Europe. They see a big recession in the making. The Eurozone is facing concurrent economic shocks from the war in Ukraine and a surge in food and energy prices exacerbated by a conflict along with a supply shock from China's zero COVID policy that has affected supply chains. For the first time, the value of the euro has dropped below the dollar, another bad sign for the Eurozone economy.
In 2021, the EU imported around 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia. The bloc's proposed gas replacements by the end of 2022, which included LNG diversification, renewables, heating efficiency, pipeline diversification, biomethane, solar rooftops, and heat pumps, however, only amount to around 102 BCM annually. The European Commission and member states' efforts to diversify away from Russian fossil fuels were also clearly demonstrated in a memorandum of understanding with Egypt and Israel for LNG exports from the East Mediterranean. However, analysts predicted that there could be significant cost implications for Europe as it looks elsewhere for gas supplies. The International Monetary Fund even indicated that escalations to existing sanctions against Russia could cascade into even steeper energy price increases, deteriorating corporate and household sentiment and financial market disruption.
The European leaders don't really care about their people, and they don't really care about peace. They are interested in serving the military-industrial complex. They're interested, as members of the ruling class, in serving the lapdogs, in Washington, in Brussels, in Vienna. And so they don't really care, ultimately, about peace and stability. Ukraine here is like a sacrificial lamb for the European leaders by which to pump in more weapons. Germany is rearming itself. NATO is going to increase its weapons. And we see, not only in Europe now, but everywhere, sanctions affect the poorest people. They affect the population. They don't as necessarily affect the leaders.
Spiraling inflation has been eating into the salaries of lower-income Europeans, and this has triggered protests and strikes across the continent over the rising cost of living. From railway workers to pilots, people from all walks of life dissatisfied with the situation have in one way or another expressed their concerns. Now, farmers in Spain have also joined the mass European protests seen in Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands. The farmers' protests seen in Spain, Poland, and Italy come after strikes in the Netherlands have led to many supermarkets running out of food as the anti-government movement continues. The rising cost of fuel has also been a contributing factor to the protests.
A 4-hour aviation strike has canceled some 500 flights in Italy during a vacation travel peak on Sunday. Aviation workers at three low-cost airlines are seeking better payments and working conditions. They took action in time with a walkout by air traffic controllers. Industrial actions come amid a surge in travel demand this summer. Airlines that laid off thousands of employees due to the COVID pandemic are now short of workforce, increasing pressure on their existing staff. The strikes follow those in other European states that have heavily disrupted air travel over the past weeks. Iran's northeastern city of Mashhad is well known as the spiritual capital of Iran since it hosts the shrine of the holy figure in Shia Islam, Imam Reza. But in this next report, Yusuf Jalala takes a look at the city's unseen site, and that's its potential for recreational tourism.
Mashhad, a tourist magnet in northeast Iran. Every year, some 30 million pilgrims from across the Muslim world travel to Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. But a few miles away from the shrine, there's a whole new world for tourists who would also like to enjoy natural resorts after a spiritual journey. Welcome to Kuh Sangi, a heaven at the heart of Mashhad, as described by this Iraqi family.
We come from Iraq. We visited the holy shrine of Imam Reza, and then I found about this amazing place called Kuh Sangi and came with my family to enjoy the scenery.
It's my second trip to Mashhad. The city offers you a whole traveling package that includes pilgrimage and recreation.
Koh Sangi is one of a myriad of attractions in Mashhad. Natural resorts such as Shandiz and Chali Dara Valley, and recreational centers such as Water Waves Land and Iram Amusement Park are among the must-see places in Mashhad. The city is also home to 10,000 historical sites. Only 1,500 of those sites have so far been registered and developed for tourists.
One of the major attractions of Mashhad is its restaurants and street eateries. Mashhad is the city of foods. It has numerous restaurants serving a variety of local and international foods. Mashhad also has more than 680 parks, providing a chance for visitors to entertain themselves besides their pilgrimage.
Mashhad is also a hotspot for health tourism in the region. Only in 2021, over 24,000 health tourists visited the city, mainly from Iraq and Oman, earning the city roughly $48 million.
Mashhad is one of the best targets in the world for health tourism. This is because of the high quality and low costs of medical care in Mashhad. Furthermore, the city offers convenient accommodation services to visitors. Up to 52% of hotels in the country are built in Mashhad.
Authorities in Mashhad say the potentials are countless, but so are the challenges. To foreign visitors, Mashhad is still a religious-only city, and many are not aware of its recreational capacities.
We at the municipality are trying to raise awareness of the attractions in Mashhad. One of those efforts is the launching of the English version of our website, which guides foreign travelers through the city online. We will soon launch the Arabic webpage as well.
Due to the large number of visitors throughout the year, Mashhad has one of the best-equipped public transport systems in the country. It has a growing subway network and bus rapid transit system, beside other transportation services, making it easy to access the desired tourist destinations in the city.
Known as the spiritual capital of Iran, Mashhad seems to offer more than a spiritual experience to visitors. With its spectacular natural resorts and growing number of recreational centers, Mashhad municipality plans to turn the city into a tourist hub in the region. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Mashhad.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello! I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company!
میزند و یا سام شیر است و یا نیرم است.
Oh, the TV is broadcasting a program on recitation of Shahnameh poetry. Oh, I love recitation of Shahnameh. I better turn up the sound. Shahnameh is one of the greatest Iranian epic poems written by late Iranian poet Ferdowsi. Today we are going to visit the mausoleum of this prominent Iranian poet in the town of Tus. Stay with me. According to historical accounts, it has been said that since Ferdowsi was a Shia Muslim, he was not permitted to be buried in the cemeteries of those times, and rather was buried in his own garden in Tus. Though he didn't have a mausoleum on his grave, the people of knowledge visited his tomb more often. For the first time, a mausoleum was built over the grave of Ferdowsi on the order of Arsalan Jazeb, one of the commanders of Sultan Mas'ud Ghaznavi. This mausoleum was standing safe and sound for about 100 years, but it was destroyed during the reign of Mongols in 638 to 641 AH. During the rule of Qazan Khan, the Ilkhanid king, a structure was built at the place where Ferdowsi was buried. This structure was also damaged during the time. During the Qajari dynasty and on the order of Nasiruddin Shah, the grave of Ferdowsi was discovered and two chambers were constructed in the area of the grave temporarily. After the Second World War, a new mausoleum was built for Ferdowsi. The construction of this mausoleum was completed in 1934. Technical miscalculation in designing the mausoleum made it vulnerable to damages. Therefore, this structure was also hurt seriously in the early years of its construction. In 1964, an engineer called Hushang Seyhun reconstructed the mausoleum of Ferdowsi. The reconstruction work was completed in 1968. During the reconstruction process, the remaining skeleton of Ferdowsi were taken out of the grave once, and after building the mausoleum, it was buried in its own place. What is interesting to note is that during the exhumation process, two skulls were found from Ferdowsi's grave instead of one, which nobody ever knows to whom one of the skulls belonged to. I am now in the area of Ferdowsi's mausoleum in the city of Tus, which is located in Khorasan Razavi province. It's green and beautiful in here. There is a pool right here. In the middle of the pool, there is the statue of Rostam, the legendary hero in Persian mythology, fighting with a dragon. The mausoleum of Ferdowsi is a few blocks away, shining like a brilliant stone. Let's get closer to it and see its beauties better. I am now in front of the mausoleum. On my right, there is the statue of Ferdowsi. He is sitting on a platform, holding Shahnameh in his hand, as if staring at his mausoleum. The structure of the mausoleum looks like a cube, which has a set of stairs on every side. On four sides of the structure, there are pieces of marble with poems of Shahnameh carved on them. It's interesting to note that the tradition of reciting Shahnameh is common in all the cities of Iran. In this tradition, the verses of Shahnameh are recited rhythmically. دلیری کجا نام او اشکبوس همی برخروشید و برسان کوس بیامد که جوید ز ایران نبرد سر هم نبرد اندر آورد بگرد. I am now inside the mausoleum. It's very beautiful and magnificent. On the walls, there are six bold designs which portray the stories of Shahnameh. The gravestone of Ferdowsi is located at the bottom. فریدون چو بشنید بکشاد گوش ز گفتار مادر برآمد به جوش ز گفتار مادر برآمد به جوش بپویم به فرمان یزدان پاک برآرم از ایوان ضحاک خاک برآرم از ایوان ضحاک خاک بپویم به فرمان یزدان پاک برآرم از ایوان ضحاک خاک. I am now standing beside the gravestone of Ferdowsi. On this gravestone, his date of birth is carved, which is 941. And his date of death is 1021. The gravestone of Ferdowsi is a marble with light color, which has red veins. This place gives me the feeling of glory and dignity.
Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
U.S. President Joe Biden has wrapped up his tour of West Asia, but it was a trip that disappointed him since it was void of any major breakthroughs. For starters, Biden sought to use his first West Asia tour to reassert Washington's influence, but that fell flat. This edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what those disappointments were. We will also look at why Iran has stated that Washington, quote, has once again resorted to the failed policy of Iranophobia, trying to create tensions and crises in the region. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. John Bustos joins us. He's a journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. Also joining us is Firas Al-Najim, manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. John Bustos, first over to you. Some of the headlines, not all of them, but quite a few, said that the U.S. President Joe Biden wanted to use this tour of West Asia in order to reassert, whatever that means, Washington's influence. However, he emerged without a single diplomatic breakthrough. Do you agree with that? Isn't that a bit harsh?
Well, I think it's actually a little bit soft. The sad fact of the matter is that not only did the advance teams, the negotiating teams, fail to negotiate some projects that could be approved during his visit, but they also made the President of the United States look even weaker and less effective than he actually is. So they've done a double whammy against their own position, and they've lost face in the region. And that is a serious loss of public recognition and public support for the parties that were depending to get the American carte blanche as they've had in the past.
Firas Al-Najim, we want to break down some of the things that happened during this trip. And one of them, obviously, was the issue of Israel and Saudi Arabia getting closer in terms of so-called normalization to come out. Basically, we're looking at the Saudi Aviation Authority first when it made an announcement, if you recall, that it's lifted the overflight restrictions on all carriers going into from Israeli planes to use Saudi airspace. And many in Israel, such as Yair Lapid, claimed it was the first official step for normalization with Saudi Arabia. That was, however, rejected flat out by Prince Faisal, who said that the move had nothing to do with Israel and was not in any way a step towards normalization. Wasn't that, in a sense, a slap in the face of Israel and, in turn, the U.S.?
Yes, I mean, it's very clear from the trip it was engineered to only visit two countries and two different regimes, pretty much, in the Middle East, and that is, first he went to Palestine, occupied Palestine, to meet with the Israeli officials, then he went to Saudi Arabia to visit the Saudi officials there. And we see that at the same time that he did this visit, and then we see this announcing of, opening the airlines and things like this, right? So this shows very clear that there is some agreements that are being binded, under the table. And now they're slowly, slowly coming out in the public. And, why did he go to only Palestine and why did he only go to Saudi Arabia? Why did he not go to, for instance, Turkey? Why didn't he go to Egypt? He didn't go nowhere except these two countries. And this is Biden's first trip outside to the Middle East since he got presidency. So he disregarded, obviously, human rights and his promises of, he said that he would hold the Saudi regime accountable for killing Khashoggi and the MBS, MBS official. He said that MBS himself will be penalized for this issue. And we see that he gave him a fist pump and he said that, that if anything like this happens again in the future, so that means pretty much this file is closed up and it's dealt with and he let it go, that there's no accountability on this issue. So Khashoggi's murder and breaking international law, going inside of a constant and doing all this was okay. They let it go because of interests and benefits. So really, they stepped on human rights and they trampled over it in this trip. And at the same time, we've seen when he visited Palestine and he met with Israeli officials, right after he left, they started bombarding Gaza. So pretty much it was a green light given by Biden for the Israeli officials to start to bomb and hurt the Palestinian people.
Well, this is the part that's somewhat confusing, John Busnish, in terms of the oil factor, because obviously lots of write-ups before this trip that the reason, the main reasons Biden is going to West Asia is to see what it can do in order to boost oil production, in particular from Saudi Arabia, if not as a whole from the GCC countries of the Persian Gulf. I'm guessing the protocol is that you don't set up something unless you know the answer in that diplomatic world, that he should have known that that is not what's going to transpire, because you had Jake Sullivan who said that any action is going to be done within the context of OPEC Plus. You even had Biden who said concrete results will not be seen for another couple of weeks. So did he set himself up for failure going there for oil production boost?
Well, I think we've got a double failure on the part of Biden by announcing results, anticipated results, which he could not deliver. And on the support staff side from the White House and from the State Department, who did not finalize any deals before the president got on the plane to the destinations. This is rudimentary first grade diplomacy. I've worked in governments in Asia, in America, North America, and in Europe, and you never set a meeting without already having drafted the fundamental agreements that should be signed by your leaders at those meetings. The president doesn't do any negotiation. The president just comes, shows the flag, and signs the pre-negotiated deals. This really indicates that U.S. foreign policy is in disarray.
So you mean they didn't do that? So you mean they just went there and they figured they're just going to talk about it?
They obviously did not do that. And the fact that the United States could not agree major decisions with its two closest allies, with Israel and Saudi Arabia, implies that Biden and his State Department simply don't have any pull. And I think that the general worldwide view of Biden is that Biden himself is already a lame duck president, and nobody knows what to expect from the United States.
Okay, talk about areas that is unknown to the U.S. president that should be part of the protocol, as our guest there talked about, Firas al-Najim, is this Israeli Defense Pact. Now, there was a lot of write-ups on that there was going to be this integration of Israel with the regional countries to sign a defense pact or to hop on board a defense pact. But then you had, upon departure, when Biden was in Saudi Arabia, the Saudi foreign minister, in a press conference, said there was no discussion on a defense alliance with Israel in the GCC summit of the Persian Gulf countries. So was that another failure then, and another, lack of reaching a consensus before Biden's trip on that issue?
I mean, you cannot believe everything they say, these officials, because they're good at manipulating, they're good at lying, they're good at fabricating. And the Saudi regime and their officials have all been raised and trained in U.S. facilities and U.S. universities and so on. And they've been working with the U.S. officials and, they've been training them to be good liars. So you can't really trust them. I'm pretty sure they had some, agreements signed under the table, and they're working on certain agreements and so on to support Israel, to normalize with Israel. And even Netanyahu, not too long ago, was saying that the relations with Saudi Arabia are getting very strong, and that he promised that if he was elected into power, that he would pact a agreement and the normalization would start between Saudi Arabia and Israel. So really, there's a lot of things happening under the table that we start to see slowly, slowly after some time. This trip was one of them, right when they were in the trip while Biden visiting these places, We've seen that there was something that propped up all of a sudden, that there's an agreement between airlines. This is something really big, you know. It's nothing small, because now they can transfer weapons to each other, they can visit each other. You know, this is a very, very bad situation right now.
Uh-huh. Something that's not obviously discussed much, at least that particular
yes.
point that you talked about. All right, let's move on to something else here that the U.S. president said to John Busnich. And he said the U.S. is going to remain or will remain fully engaged in West Asia. Quoting him, we will not walk away and leave a vacuum to be filled by China, Russia, or Iran. Why does the U.S. think that there's going to be a vacuum in the first place? And if there is one, why does it think it needs to fill it? Because if it needs to fill it, then you would look at their achievements. But what are their achievements?
Right. I mean, you've hit the nail right on the head here. First of all, the vacuum that Biden is referring to is the kind of vacuum that was left in Afghanistan when the United States suddenly pulled out without even removing its own military equipment to the tune of billions of dollars. So the United States has demonstrated by its own actions within this past year that they are leaving not only massive power vacuums in places that they've previously occupied, but they've also left donations of billions of dollars of weapons to the people that they call their enemies. So we know that they're not competent. And by reinforcing the worry about a vacuum being created, Biden has actually just focused more attention on the United States failures. Secondly, when we talk about the United States being present and not allowing a vacuum to be filled by somebody else, what they're really talking about is militarily, because the United States generally talks softly and carries a big stick. And so the United States is going to attempt to show by a deployment of forces, by bringing the fleets in the region, that they're engaged and that they're threatening military action to reinforce their positions on a number of issues. That alone is going to be a massive expenditure of U.S. taxpayers' funds for a conflict which is 95% not likely to happen. So we've got a real mess at the top in the White House, and this is just another example of the problem.
Well, the Palestinian issue was something that really was a huge disappointment. I'm sure you'll agree for us on the team. And it's really, I'm not too sure what word to use. When you see what the president did, the outcome, where from what I'm understanding here, no progress at all when it came to obviously any type of peace negotiations. There was no condemnation of any kind behind all the different violations of Israel, of which he focused instead on economic measures, which included 4G internet for Palestinians. Do you think 4G internet for Palestinians is the number one issue of concern?
I mean, it's very clear, even when he was bringing up the name of the well-known Palestinian, also American holding citizen, journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, he couldn't even spell her name right. You know, he was announced, he couldn't even, pronounce it right. You know what I mean? He said it very, very incorrectly, and he was stuttering, you know, because he knew this was a big crime and it's something that's important for the Palestinians. And many of the relatives of that journalist were sitting inside that room. And, you know, he was very weak. And you can see about her, he didn't cover. He wouldn't even want to visit Shireen Abu Akleh's family members and relatives. Later, he announced that they're welcome to come to the States, but they're thinking about it. They don't know if they want to go there because he disregarded them fully when he came to the land where she was killed. The West Bank, we've seen there's so much violations there, international laws being breached, evictions, and thefts of homes and rebuilding of illegal settlements. He didn't speak anything about that. He just talked about, just briefly said, oh, we care about dignity of the Palestinians and human rights and so on. He gave some pocket change to the Palestinian promise of $100 million or so on. Okay, and like you said, the 4G. I think the main concern is obviously human rights. I think the main concern is liberty, sovereignty, having a recognized, having embassies that are really recognized, where Palestinians are actually regarded as humans. Unfortunately, this man comes over there, does not even care about the Palestinians as if they're not even humans. And then when he goes to the side of the Israelis, and the occupiers, he treats them like gold, and he assures them so many things and gives them such big agreements, as if they need more agreements and they need more help and more assistance, where they're the ones that are occupying and they're the ones that are violating and they're the ones that are killing and they're the ones that are doing all kinds of crimes. And he showed clearly that he does not care about the Palestinians. And unfortunately, Mahmoud Abbas didn't hold him accountable and didn't, make a very strong stand against him. He should have actually refused to see him, because there is no real, there's no real meeting. What has he presented? Before he meets him, he should have presented to him a real plan on how the Palestinians are going to get some kind of statement.
Sure. Well, follow me on this train of thought and see if you agree with me, John Bosnich. I'm looking how the U.S. has obviously is all out against Russia on all fronts when you take a look at the way that it's acting against Russia. And it, in turn, then has its eye out for China. We know that for a fact. Now, if China is Saudi Arabia's number one customer, I know Russia has overtaken it recently, but in essence, Saudi Arabia sells the most oil to China. And taking a look at what Antony Blinken said last week at the G20, warning China not to support Russia and buy oil from Russia, doesn't Saudi Arabia then conclude, wait a minute, I'm going to be that China where the U.S. is going to say, hey, don't sell your oil to China down the road? That's what the U.S. is going to do, because that's what it's doing right now when it comes to Russia and China. So why should Saudi Arabia even embrace the U.S. in any shape or form?
Well, the way you posed your question makes it sound like Saudi Arabia has a choice. And in fact, the power structures in the Middle East basically do not leave a choice to Saudi Arabia except to do what the United States says, because without the United States military support, Saudi Arabia is a non-viable, non-defendable state. And this is the situation that the United States president came thinking could dictate anything he wanted, and even that, he was unable to dictate properly what he wanted. I think we're seeing a real exposure of how weak and how disorganized the United States is under the current administration, and it's made even worse by a president who's accused of being senile, not only by his opponents, but by his allies.
Qatar made a strong statement for Al Sanjain. The prime addressing the summit was the Emir Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. He went all out against Israel, blaming Israel for regional instability. He slammed the regime for illegal settlements. Let's see, what else did he do? And, of course, the blockade on the Gaza Strip. Now, it's interesting that he would do that, given the fact that there's a U.S. military base in Qatar. What do you think about the statements made there by the Emir?
I mean, I think they're good statements, and that's a different tone than the Saudis and the Bahrainis and the Emiratis and all these other GCC countries, or the ones that are silent, such as Oman. It's something that we can build on. Hopefully, that really they can get some sovereignty, as you said, they have a big U.S. base there. So it's kind of surprising how we can speak in this kind of manner. Whoever speaks against the Israeli occupation, against the violations, against the crimes that are happening, the major blockade on the people of Gaza, especially after they bombarded them right after Biden visited them, that shows a very clear sign that Biden gave them a green light to bomb Gaza. So, that's a good sign. It's another regional country that hopefully, Iran and the axis of resistance can ally with and work with on certain fronts, especially for the Palestinian cause. And we hope more countries can awaken their governments and the governments can awaken and be able to really stand up for the Palestinian people and for the dignity of Palestinians, because, injustice anywhere is injustice everywhere. They're part of the region, and the Palestinians deserve human rights. They've been trampled on for many, many years now, 74 years. And it's continuous, and it's growing, actually. The situation is getting worse and worse. And whenever we see a new Israeli official, you see more crimes, more aggressions, more manipulation, more lies, and a harder life for the Palestinians. We can see very clear, even the Palestinians, how did they welcome the Israelis? They put signs up saying that this is apartheid, and that we want justice for Shireen Abu Akleh. So sure. It shows very clear that the Palestinians were rejecting the trip and weren't happy with Biden coming.
I saved the best for last, and it has to deal with Iran there, John Bosnich. Obviously, we saw how Biden was embraced by Israel. We saw the doubling down of military support practically, not only for the Iron Dome, but this new laser machine of some kind, as if the Iron Dome was working so well that they now moved on to another equipment. Maybe that is supposed to make up the deficiency of the Iron Dome. Anyways, interestingly, Lapid said, got to use force against Iran. Diplomacy is not going to work. Talks are inadequate, of which after all the talk that Israel gave, at the end Biden said, well, we're still going to go for the diplomatic route. Even though he did say, if that doesn't work, then force will be used as a last resort. That has been taken as a disappointment by Israel and its officials, because they say that that's not what they had hoped for. How do you see the outcome of that?
Well, there are two sides to that coin. We're going for the diplomatic fig leaf to of the American policy. They will take a violent response. And every action that is coordinated between Israel and America should be taken in light of a very important fact. There was a book produced by Dr. John Mearsheimer at the University of Chicago called The Israel Lobby. And in that book, he pointed out that 60% of the donations to the Democratic Party and 40% of the donations to the Republican Party come from the Israel Lobby. So it wasn't Biden going to give orders to Israel. It was Biden going to Israel to take orders. That's what happened.
So is he going to get the 60%?
They always get their money. And in return for the money for their electoral campaigns, they have to do what the Israel Lobby tells them to do. People should read that book, The Israel Lobby, Dr. John Mearsheimer. It is an eye-opener about international politics involving Israel and the United States.
Very well. We're going to leave it there. Thank you very much. That's John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst from Belgrade. First, Alain Jean, thank you so much from Toronto, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Vitakvay and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
اليوم أكملت لكم دينكم وأتممت عليكم نعمتي ورضيت لكم الإسلام دينا.
Today I have perfected for you your religion and completed my favor on you and chosen for you Islam as a religion.
Eid Qadir celebrates the divine appointment of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of the Holy Prophet, as Prophet Muhammad's vicegerent and successor. Here at IRIB English Radio, congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the auspicious and joyous occasion of Eid Qadir. A happy Eid Qadir to all our listeners.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, everyone. Welcome to Arab English Radio. This is Asma, your humble host for today's episode, and you're hearing me from Q&A on Islamic Belief, where you could get the answers to all your questions. Well, today we have Dr. Karimi, scholar of religious studies, who will help us with the answers. Assalamu alaikum and welcome, Dr. Karimi.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you here. listeners, previously on Q&A on Islamic belief, we opened a box of worms that had so much of discussions. We were talking about the fact that whether those people who are not true believers in Islam would go to heaven or not. We actually had a great discussion on that. But we are reaching to the point that we will talk about mustadafin, the concept of those people who are deprived of knowledge and information about the true religion, which is Islam. So, Dr. Karimi.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, we have this concept taken from or explicitly mentioned in the Quran. Let me read three verses of chapter An-Nisa, which are very interesting, explicitly talking about these people. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala said in chapter 4, verse 97, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ إِنَّ الَّذِينَ تَوَفَّاهُ الْمَلَائِكَةُ ظَالِمِي أَنفُسِهِمْ. Indeed, those whom the angels take away, talking about the time of their death, while they are wronging themselves. قَالُوا فِيمَ كُنْتُمْ. They ask, what estate were you in? The angels asking those people. قَالُوا كُنَّا مُسْتَدْعَفِينَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. They say we were... Now, the translation here is oppressed. It's not a good translation. What you mentioned was much better. Deprived of getting the knowledge of the truth.
They did not have access to...
Exactly. We were deprived, we were mustadaf in the land. Now, those angels say, قَالُوا أَلَمْ تَكُنْ أَرْضُ اللَّهِ وَسَحَدًا فَتُهَاجِرُوا فِيهَا. The angels are mentioning what you mentioned in the previous session, the fact that in our time, no one may have the excuse that I do not have
access. Because the internet has made everything pretty much easier.
This is mentioned by the
you
angels.
You're an armchair traveler.
Yeah. The angels do not talk about Googling, but they mention as follows. أَلَمْ تَكُنْ أَرْضُ اللَّهِ وَاسَعَةً فَتُهَاجِرُوا فِيهَا. The angel says, was not Allah's earth vast enough so that you might migrate in it? Meaning that, for example, in that time, internet was not available. But you could migrate to other places to find the truth. فَأُولَٰئِكَ مَأْوَاهُمْ جَهَنَّمْ وَسَاءَتْ مَصِيرًا. The refuge of such will be hell, and it is an evil destination.
Such a bad destination.
So here we have a group of people who claim to be mustad'af, to be deprived, but the answer of God through the angels is that no, it's just an excuse. And many people in our time may have the same excuse, but that excuse might not be accepted by God. But then the following verse reads, إِلَّا الْمُسَدْعَفِينَ مِنَ الرِّجَالِ وَالنِّسَاءِ وَالْوِلْدَانِ لَا يَسْتَتِعُونَ حِيلَةً وَلَا يَهْتَدُونَ سَبِيلًا. Except the oppressed, again this translation, which might be better to say deprived, except the deprived among men, women, and children who have neither access to any means nor are guided to any way. So God says that there is an exception. We may think of a group of people who have no way, لا يستطيعون حيلة ولا يهتدون سبيلة. They have no way to find the truth. So this verse is talking specifically about a group of people who try their best to find the truth, but they are not able to find the truth. For example, at that time, even they are not able to migrate. In our time, they are living in Amazon forest, for example.
Yes, you talked about it in previous session.
Yeah.
Those who do their best and yet they do not get to find the truth.
Exactly.
Their excuse is actually accepted.
Yeah, but what happens to them? So we have the believers, they will go to paradise. Of course, when we are talking about believers, it depends on their actions. If they have no sins, then there is no punishment.
Yeah.
If they have some sins, some of the sins are forgiven through afflictions that people face in this world, like illnesses. Some sins are forgiven through the time.
Catastrophes.
Yeah, and the next stage is the time of your death. You see, some good people have a very difficult time when they pass away. It's not a sign of them being bad people. No, they are very good people. There are some remaining sins, and those remaining sins are forgiven through that difficult.